Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward.
Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity, part of the Podmatch podcast network. This is George Soroy, and thank you so much for being here. And I am so thrilled to have as my guest this week, Laura Buchwald. Laura is not only a prolific writer and editor of various articles that you've seen all around the country, but she's also part of the amazing team of authors at Ronan Weatherford. She has her first two books in her trilogy already out, with the third one in development, which sounds a lot like my own situation right now with my Excelsior books. So I'm very one of those things that I'm very that definitely struck a chord for me the more I learned about her. And I'm also thrilled to say that she is also a podcast host of her own. So having someone with all these different types of credits, with writing, fiction, nonfiction, editing, podcasting, it's only natural that she be here as a guest on Excelsior Journeys. So I really hope that you enjoy my conversation with my guest this week. Allow me to introduce Laura Buchwald. Laura, how are you?
I am doing great. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you very much for being here. This is always, it's always exciting to speak with a fellow author over at Ronan Weatherford, and especially knowing everything that you've been doing and everything that you're currently doing with the podcast, with the books that have already come out through Ronan Weatherford.
So are you working on your third in a trilogy as well? Is that what I hear?
I sure am. I'm doing two different things right now because I got two different trilogies that are locked in over there. One of them is, it's all finished, but it's going through the editing. So I got my notes already back. The editing team there is absolutely stellar. I was definitely terrified to open up my documents to see all the notes. While there were quite a few of the notes, I was happy to see that the story notes were all pretty much intact. So I was very upset. But I'm excited about making the different changes for that one. And then for my other trilogy, parts one and two are done. They have been done. I'm very happy with them. And I'm just working on part three. And part threes are rough, aren't they?
They are rough. They have a very big job to fulfill.
They got to stick the landing.
They got to stick the landing, and you're beholden to what you've written into books one and two. And that's something that I'm realizing in drafting my third one, is some of the decisions I made in book two, had I really thought them through, I might have tweaked some things, but I am beholden. So I'm going to see it through, obviously. But yeah, this is my first trilogy, and it's exciting and it's daunting and it's all of the above.
Very much. And so the previous two books there are The Coat Check Girl and The Book of Reservations, right? I love that book, that title too, The Book of Reservations. It's so, I love the biblical shift that it gives. So it sounds like the second one, if I'm not mistaken, is definitely a deeper story than the first one.
It is. It's a continuation of the world that I created in The Coat Check Girl, but because I knew the characters better, I was able to dive deeper into what was going on with them. I didn't think I could love a book as much as I loved my first one, your first published book. What an exciting thing. But I've really come to appreciate Book of Reservations as well. And I'm getting some nice feedback on it. It just came out in December.
Excellent. Excellent. Very excited about that. So that's been really close then at this point. So what did you wind up doing to celebrate the launch of that one?
That one, I didn't celebrate quite as much as I did the first. It came out in December. So we were very close to the holidays. I had my little quiet celebrations with my friends and family, but I didn't do a big launch party the way I did for The Coat Check Girl. I have done a lot of podcast and radio interviews for The Book of Reservations, and that's been so much fun. I will never tire of talking about it, and I've met some fabulous people, yourself included, you know, and had some great interviews over the past couple of months. And as the pressure of having the third one to write makes any celebration somewhat short-lived because you have to dive right back into the work that you're doing. But what an honor to know what it is that I'm supposed to be writing next.
Yes. Yeah. And just really just focusing on, okay, like I've already come this far. And that's something that a lot of people really need to remember, especially when they're working on a trilogy like this and they're on part three. You're already 66.6% of the way there. So you got to think of it that way. Instead of thinking like, okay, I got to start all over. I get that feeling, but at the same time, it's just like, you got to remind yourself how far you've gone.
That is, thank you for that. I need to hear that, especially right now. And that is so true. We're assuming this will just be a trilogy, which I know mine will. We're finishing the story that we've written 2/3 of already.
Yeah.
I didn't set out to write multiples. When I wrote The Code Check Girl, I thought it was going to be a standalone. This whole process has taken me by surprise in a really positive way.
That's great.
Yeah, and I have Ronan Weatherford to thank for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. These guys have been just fantastic. And I am really excited to have my own books done so I can make them feel that, okay, this has been a good investment on their part. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like I feel like the real pressure for that. It's just like I'm excited for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it. And that's something I try to come back to when I'm feeling a little creatively blocked or feeling frustrated or stuck, the excitement of it. That's something that I want to always harness. Not every writing day is going to be as successful or as productive, but just having an appreciation for the overall process, I think, really helps, and keeping that in mind and doing it because we love it. That's why we write, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes,
I'm harnessing the excitement as well and hoping that will get me over the finish line for my draft of book three.
Yeah. And definitely no disrespect to anyone who wants to go the indie route. And I've been there. I've done that originally with a previous edition of the first Excelsior book. But when it comes to indie publishing, I totally understand the impetus behind that. You want that control. You want to make sure that you have the final say on this and this. And I totally get that. But at the same time, it means a lot to me, and you'll probably feel the same way, to have a team backing me up.
Absolutely. And yeah, and with all respect to independent publishing, which has come so far since, you know, the early days of it, my podcast partner, actually, who's an incredibly prolific novelist, exclusively self-publishes by choice. And I do understand that. And for me personally, it has been really nice to have the backing of the team, to have as editors and cheerleaders and support. And I think that's something that I personally have needed to really see this through to completion, but I see the advantages to both. Certainly with self-independent publishing, every single creative decision is entirely your own. And I certainly see the appeal there. And Ronan Weatherford has been really collaborative, which has been great.
They really are. They really have been. And I'm enthusiastic because of their enthusiasm toward me as well. So one of the things that I love to hear about, because you were mentioning everything like the writing, the editing, and also the podcasting, everything that you've been doing, I'm always fascinated by people telling their story of their own road to creativity. And that's that moment where you either experience something or meet someone or see something and just, ooh, that's what I want to do. And whatever road you're on, you hit that exit ramp, you're on a whole new highway and you're going in a completely different direction. What was it about writing that really grabbed your attention in the first place?
I've been writing creatively since I've learned how to write. And I just fell in love with storytelling and with using my imagination. And I was a voracious reader as a kid. I go through peaks and valleys with reading now. I'm in a good reading clip at the moment. I love storytelling of all sorts. The Coat Check Girl, which is the predecessor to the Book of Reservations, the idea came to me through this set of circumstances many years ago. And I started writing it just to see what would come of it. I didn't really even say to myself, I'm writing a novel. I just wanted to see if I could take this story, see where I could take this story. I started it, I put it down for many years. And then what was really cool is I started dreaming about the characters I had created. Ooh. And I realized that they had some hold on my self-conscious that I could not get rid of them. And I had to see these stories through some sort of completions. That was really exciting. That was this kind of synergy that I've experienced only a couple of times, but it's really great when that happens.
So feeling that sort of urge from within mm-hmm. to the point where it's just invading your sleep. And
yeah,
that's an awesome feeling. Just
it was an
knowing
awesome feeling. Knowing that it's really there, and that because as a writer, you get an idea, and like, how do you trust an idea when you first get it? It's a lot of trial and error. But just when these same characters were coming to me, I actually dreamt a version of the ending of the first book, which, you know, I reworked it.
Yeah.
But that was how the ending kind of came to me. So I felt like I was able to trust my imagination when I realized that it was infiltrating my sleep.
At that point, it's almost like it's transcribing.
Yeah, it was a really unique experience, and one that I appreciate, one that I wish I could harness at will, but I can't. I wish I could dream the ending of book three. I know what book three will be, but I know what the ending of it will be, but just, yeah, there was something really cool and validating about having my subconscious take over in those moments.
And then so you're able to, after everything is basically just kind of incubating inside mm-hmm. you, now all of a sudden it's time to sit down at your keyboard and start getting it out. What was that feeling like when it was starting to actually pour out of you?
It's a great feeling. Somebody asked me where I find the joy in writing recently. And for me, the joy really is in the output, even though you know that a lot of when you're just getting that first draft out, you know, a lot of that is going to wind up on the cutting room floor or you have to write it all out in order to sculpt it into the final product. But seeing that word count rise is really motivating for me. Even though I know, like I said, that it's not all going to wind up in the final draft, it's just when you hit that flow state. And this is something I was telling somebody recently who was asking about how to deal with writer's block or whatever you want to call it, writer's distraction, writer's insecurity. You can't, when you're on a deadline or when you are beholden to somebody or accountable to somebody for your work, you can't just write when you feel like it or when inspiration strikes. So you just really have to show up to the page and generate output and trust that somewhere within however many words you get out in a given day, somewhere within that is something that's going to wind up in your final product.
Yeah. It feels like writer's malaise kind of thing.
Yes.
It's something that I've dealt with way more often than I care to admit.
Yeah. And I often wonder what exactly it is. Like I don't know how much of it is blocked, how much of it is just, there is a certain amount of self-doubt that comes up as well, certainly for mm-hmm. me,
oh, yeah.
But you just have to power through that and trust. And on the days when you know that you're not necessarily writing your best work, but you're writing something, you just have to trust that the sum total is going to be positive, even if every single moment to moment is not.
You definitely have to have that sort of feeling in there, because you can throw like a whole bunch of stuff at the screen, but at the same time, those nuggets that stay, that's going to be a lot more valuable than if you didn't throw anything at the screen at all.
Exactly. An old editor of mine said, if you don't just get your entire messy, messy first draft out there, you risk missing out on the lifeblood of your story. Yeah. And it's true, within all of those many words that you throw out, there's a through line, and there's something that there's your story engine, and there's the heart of your story. And so you might have to delete many more words than feels comfortable. But I don't think any of the writing is in vain, even the ones that don't ever wind up seeing the light of day.
Yeah.
I think it all counts toward the final product.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so you got that first draft done. And mm-hmm. when it was done, did you feel like, ooh, I'm onto something here? And you started, was the enthusiasm always there as it was coming out?
It ebbed and flowed. I started for The Coat Check Girl, this is for the very mm-hmm. first one. I started it back in 2007. So it was mm-hmm. a long time that I put it down
yep.
before I picked it back up. And then I workshopped it with various writing groups and I got good feedback, and I just got more and more excited about the story. And when I finally printed out my first full draft, what a feeling that was. And somebody advised me to print it out, said that there's something neurological that happens when you see your work printed out in front of you. And it's so true.
Yeah.
It feels legitimate, more so than maybe it does when it's just floating around on your hard drive.
Yeah. It feels tangible.
It's tangible. It's
something you created.
I feel as though I'm struggling a bit with book three, but I printed out what I have yesterday. And
nice.
It's thick, and it's like, it can't all be bad. I mean, and I know it's not all bad. I know there's some great stuff in there. There's just a lot of extraneous and I have to do a lot of surgical removing and repurposing of what is in there right now. But it did feel really good to see that. And it feels like a legitimate, it's a book, it's in book form. I can actually sit down and hold the paper and read it. I love reading books. I read online as well, or on my Kindle, but there's nothing like the feeling of holding a book, and
there really
holding your own work does the same.
That's something that I also wanted to bring up, because you got the story into the hands of Ronan Weatherford. What was the feeling like when they gave you those wonderful words that they're going to go with you?
It was fabulous. So it was I started querying my first book at the end of 2019, and then the pandemic showed up, and so everything shut down. And I finally heard back from my agent in the summer of 2020. We did a long round of submissions to varying degrees of encouragement and frustration, and she kept saying it only takes one yes. And what a yes I got. Not only did Ronan Weatherford want to publish it, but they wanted multiples. And without really thinking through what that entailed, I just immediately jumped at the chance, and then thought, wait, that means I actually have to write multiples, you know. But I was so thrilled, and it felt so validating.
Yes. Yes.
That not only did they like the first manuscript that I had completed, but they wanted the story to continue. I remember getting those initial notes back from my editor, and it's daunting when you look and you see just how many of them there are, but it's also somebody's taking your story seriously enough to edit it and to give you feedback and to want to make it better. And that's a really valuable feeling as a writer.
And that's something that a lot of writers really need to remember, is that the editor is not trying to tell your story in their own way or something. They're not they're definitely not trying to sabotage you. They want to make your book the very best it can be.
Yeah.
And the best way to do that is
to go by these notes. The editors at Ronan Weatherford are so skilled, and they trust our voices. They want these stories to be told in our voices, because you can tell when you read something and somebody has tried to fit what might be marketable nowadays, but it doesn't feel authentic, or it doesn't feel...
Yeah.
They want us to write the books that we love to read and that we feel proud to have our name on, and that they feel proud to have their name on as well. So a good editor is not going to edit just for the sake of editing. They're going to edit because they feel they know how you can make your story. And that's really the key, how you can make your story better. They're not putting words in our mouths. They're, you know, suggesting areas that could be stronger, areas would benefit from X, Y, and Z. And it's a really important relationship between a writer and their editor.
And having worked with two different editors before even working with Ronan Weatherford, it's quite the experience. And I honestly, my books would not be anywhere near the kind of quality that they have now without them.
Same,
Because they really stepped up and did everything that they could to force some different answers out of me. They didn't provide answers themselves. Mm-hmm. They just provided questions. And it didn't have to be the right or wrong answer, but there had to be an answer.
And that's what a great editor will do, is ask the questions that need to be answered. But at the same time, prior to Ronan Weatherford, I worked with a freelance editor who felt my story started about a third of the way in from where I had originally started it. So at the time, I was hardwired to think everybody's an expert except me. So if somebody's saying that this is where your story starts, this is where my story starts. So I changed it and had a complete manuscript, and it just didn't feel right. I missed my initial beginning, and it wasn't just a matter of you always have to the expression is kill your darlings. You always have to get rid of some of what you have originally held onto in your manuscript. But in this case, I just really felt that starting it where I had originally started it was authentically how I wanted to tell this story. And I reverted back to it. And that's what is now published today, is my original beginning. So it's a combination of understanding that they're really there to help you and work with you and make your story as strong as it can be. And also trusting your own voice. But it's not about ego. It's about, no, this just really feels right to me.
Yeah. And I kind of going back to the phrase, kill all your darlings. That's something that you and I have definitely heard multiple times from different people. Mm-hmm. I look at it, my interpretation of it is just, it's not so much kill everything that you love. It's be prepared to kill something that is impeding with the flow of the overall project, even if it is a moment that you love.
Even if it's a moment you love or a character you love. I've worked with several memoir writers over the years, and what is tricky there is having a writer who's telling a story that really happened, but the way it really happened and every single person who was part of it really happening might not make for great storytelling. So it's a lot harder to kill your darling when it's who was part of a scene in your life. But if that character in a memoir is not pertinent to the story, then you kind of have to, you're not reshaping the truth. You're fine tuning it. And that's what we have to do as well, is not every funny character or great, interesting character necessarily makes sense for the story that we want to tell.
Yep. It's just like with biopics. A lot of screenwriters and producers, what they'll do is they'll take a handful of characters, they'll put them all together as an amalgam of various characters, and they'll be the character that follows the subject along. I remember DeVito did that with Hoffa. He took a handful of different characters and created the Bobby Charo character that he played following Jack Nicholson as Hoffa around.
I love good biopics, and that's so true. That is exactly what they do, is, they make an amalgam of characters. Because there may be any number of people in our lives who kind of function in the same way as a soundboard or as this or as that. And it gets muddy when you have too many people on the page or on the screen. So you do need to streamline for the sake of effective storytelling.
Exactly. Exactly. So having gone through that process, you've gone through the editing, and what were your thoughts when you saw the cover?
Oh my gosh.
That's such a great looking.
I love both of my covers. And again, I didn't think I could love a cover as much as I loved the Coat Check Girl until I saw the Book of Reservations. You know, what the fabulous creative team at Ronan Weatherford has done so well is the weather and the season play a big role in both of these books. Two very different seasons. One is a very rainy summer, the other is autumn. And they have captured that. They've captured those seasons in New York City so beautifully. I can't imagine another cover. I had a friend was reading The Coat Check Girl in an airport, and two different people came up to ask what she was reading based on the cover.
Wow.
I know. I actually told our creative team that speaks volumes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, people can see the book like out in the wild. That's something that we all yearn for. That's a great feeling.
Yeah.
And then there's also the other feeling that we as writers all yearn for, that when that moment comes, we'll never get old. And that's that moment where you go through the writing, you do the work. The editor's done the work. You've done the work editing the edits.
Yes, you have to edit the edits and then edit the copy edits.
Then you got the formatting, then you got the proofreading, and then you got the cover design, and then everything is all together. And then there's that moment when you get to hold that finished book in your hands.
Yes.
And tell us the moment. That's one of my favorites to hear about with other authors.
It was so meaningful. It was such a long time coming, both of these, but particularly the first one. It was such a long time coming. I couldn't believe, here's my name in print on this gorgeous book that I'm holding. And I remember being giddy and saying, these are words that I've written that are on these pages.
Yep.
And my friend said, yes, it's a book. But it's an indescribable feeling of just pride and giddiness and always a little bit of imposter syndrome for me.
Oh, yeah.
And I think for a lot of writers, not that it would ever be a charitable decision on the publisher's part to publish your book. But yeah, it's a beautiful feeling holding your finished product in your hand. And then looking at my two books next to each other, I long for when the third one is there, trilogy yep. is complete.
Oh, that would have to be like the best feeling. I'm excited for the same thing to have that as well. And then with that,
you got the finished book, right?
I'm close. The funny thing about my Excelsior series, this character goes back to 1992 with me. That was someone that I created the summer of 92 as a response to needing a new character within this little universe of characters that went back all the way to grade school with me. And yeah, so it's quite a history with them. But this guy was meant to be like the centerpiece of this whole universe. And as time passed and I just kept on picking at him, I realized in 2007 when I discovered National Novel Writing Month that my time had come to finally put his story out there. And that was the plan. And so my guy, Excelsior, originally he was supposed to be like, he was going to drop into a world that was already in progress, but he's actually starting it up. He's starting up this whole universe now. And so the first two stories were not carbon copies, but they were like, there was definitely a good sized skeleton of stories one and two in those steno notebooks that I filled in high school with stories about him. Part three, it always felt like I never really had a set story. It was always like a bunch of wouldn't this be cool moments. And mm-hmm. so I had to figure out what that eventual story would be. So those fragments of a story were always hanging around, but they never had an actual skeleton. So that's what I'm doing now, is I'm trying to get that skeleton formed while taking all of these moments and moving them into the form of a cohesive story. So it's a harder process than the other
two. It is a harder process, yeah. It sounds. Wow. And how are you feeling about it?
I'm feeling good about it. When I was working on the second book, there were originally like a handful of chapters that were there because my story editor said, Excelsior's got to go on a walkabout. He's got to regain control and regain connection with this planet that he's on because he's been on Earth for so long. So he's got to do all this and he's got to go from place to place. And you got to incorporate the reader in there too. So that way they know what's going on. I was like, fair enough. Finally, my editor at my previous publisher, she looked at it and immediately just goes, these chapters read like a travelogue. It's just like, okay.
So
I had to figure out what I can do with that. And so I took the essence of it. And instead of having the character, us first meeting him down on the ground, I remembered he's a god in human form. So let's stick him up in the sky. And I went ahead and just had his consciousness be removed from his body and do a whole wrap around the whole planet. And then eventually go right back into his body. And then he can float back down. And by doing that, he went to all those different places and gave like a Cliff Notes version of what was there and then shot right back into his mind. And I was able to accomplish exactly what I had done before, but it only took about a page and a half. So,
oh, wow. Oh, isn't that interesting? Okay.
Yeah. And so I was able to kind of get back on with the story, but I liked a lot of the moments that were there. So all those other chapters that I'd taken out before, they are now being repurposed into a section in part three. So,
yeah, that's why none of the writing that we do is in vain, because it may wind up elsewhere.
That's what I always tell people. My daughter started writing because she's seen the books that I do, and she mm-hmm. wanted to go ahead and start her own story. And she was liking the process, but she didn't like where the story was going. So she wanted to start a whole new one. I said, that's fine, but start a new document. Do not write over that old one. And you'll be happy that you didn't delete it.
Yeah. I found a very old printed out draft of Coachette Girl just last week and was amazed at things I didn't even remember were in it
yep.
that were so different. from the finished product.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you got me thinking that I should take a look at that first draft of Excelsior that I wrote back in 2008, because I'm sure that there are different elements that were in there that I edited out way, way, way back when I was doing those first rewrites. And I'm sure there's something different there that can be mined for further for other content. So that would be interesting.
Absolutely.
So you were mentioning before that you had done, you opted not to have a launch party for a Book of Reservations, but you did have one for the Coat Check Girl. What was that one like?
I did. That was great. That was in the lounge in my building here in New York City. And nice. I had a friend who's a novelist who also teaches fiction at John Jay College here.
Oh.
And she was the moderator. She interviewed me. And then I had probably about 50 people there, and I read and answered questions and fell in love with that process. And then the book, part of the book one takes place in New Orleans. There's a New Orleans theme in book two. But so we had New Orleans inspired menu of hors d'oeuvres and cocktails and things. And it was great. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And I thought about doing something for book two, but again, that came out right around the holidays, right before the holidays. So everybody was busy, and then people don't want to go out. It's been a particularly wintry winter, and hard to get people to leave the warmth of their apartments to traipse out for parties. But I may do something in the spring, maybe when the paperback comes out, I'll do something.
Oh, fun. I would actually recommend for having the next big launch party when the trilogy is done.
Oh, there you go. That's a great idea.
Because once that one comes out, then all of a sudden you have people that are vying that may not have known that book two has come out already, but so they can get book two and three while they're there. And then there's going to be other people that have never even heard about it. They're going to want to get all three at once.
That is really smart. And I think I'm going to borrow that. So thank you.
Please.
That is really smart. And that's also impetus. I love throwing a party. So that's impetus to finish book three.
I actually wound up not even throwing my own party even for when Excelsior and the second book Ever Upward had come out with at their previous publisher, because I already had two different parties for the first Excelsior when it went from its self-publishing form to a small press. But at the same time, like each time that it's gone, the book has gotten better and better. So it's never the same book over and over again. But I never gave myself a chance to really celebrate the release of the first two with their previous publisher. So when book three is finished, you expect to hear there's going to be one hell of a party in St. Louis, because
all right,
I'm going to be pushing three books at once. So I'm very excited about that.
That's amazing. That's really smart. Okay. I'm going to do the same.
I even looked at how to put together a proper step and repeat. That way to have all three logos on there.
Yeah.
And to see what happens there. Cause I plan on really, really soaking it up.
Good. I've never been to St. Louis.
Especially with how long it's been. There you go.
Angle for an invite.
Oh, of course. And hopefully we'll be able to talk about it on your own show.
Yes.
Because that's something that I'm really excited to hear about, because I love hearing from other podcasters as well, knowing what got them going on their own show. So tell us a little bit about your show.
Sure. Our show is called People Who Do Things. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Richmond, Virginia before. I actually met my podcast co-host at a writing conference in Richmond, Virginia.
No
back kidding. In 2016, the James River Writing Conference. Writers Conference. And his name is John H. Matthews. He's a prolific novelist and a good friend. And we had always talked about collaborating on something. I pictured it being something in print. But then during lockdown, he asked me if I had any interest in doing a podcast. I knew very little about podcasts. I don't think I'd ever listened to a podcast at that point. Fortunately, he's great with all the technical stuff. So what we decided to do was a show about the creative process, where a lot of the episodes are just he and I talking, but there are several where we've interviewed other writers of novels, poetry, screenwriters, television writers, songwriters, playwrights.
Yeah.
And we just talk about various aspects of the writing process, the successes and the frustrations. And we talk about the research that goes into our writing and the importance of titles, and we get technical about what programs we write on, and it's been a lot of fun. We had a really great clip going during lockdown where we were releasing one a week and it was very ambitious. And now we look back and think how sweet that was that we thought we could keep that going. We don't keep it going at quite the same clip, but we just have very different schedules. He lives in Virginia, so we talk via Zoom. The title, People Who Do Things, comes from a Dorothy Parker poem about how exhausting artists are. And it's a great poem. I believe it's called Bohemia. Worth looking at. Nice. Yeah, so it's a lot of fun. And as writing is such a solitary endeavor, that it's so great to build community. And that's something my podcast has definitely played a major role in helping me feel like I have a writing community.
I've been feeling the same way about that. That's really why I have so many authors on my show, because it really does mean a lot to have that sort of community and knowing that there are different creatives that I can talk with about their craft, about what it is that they do and what they love to do and their issues that are holding them back. And there's always something that's getting in the way.
Always. Yeah.
You know, dealing with anxiety, depression, self-doubt, fatigue, imposter syndrome, perfectionism, the world itself. Yeah.
It can be hard when things are so in flux. Sometimes it can be hard just to feel like writing fiction is of value, but of course it's of value. Storytelling is of tremendous value and always will be.
Yeah.
And it's really kept, writing these books has kept me company through some difficult times. So I appreciate having these to kind of give me some purpose and shape to my days when things are in flux in other areas of life.
And so if there is someone that's out there that's in the same position you are, they have a story, it's one that they themselves have been dreaming about and trying to get it out there. They're not really sure exactly what to do with it. What is it that you would recommend that they do as a starting tip?
You mean to start the actual writing process?
Yeah. If they have an idea,
that's been
eating away at them.
Sure. Just show up. There are, as we talked earlier about the importance of getting that messy first draft out, I think the idea of perfectionism gets in the way of a lot of beginning writers. What if I'm writing this and it's not good and it's a mess? It's supposed to be a mess in the beginning. It's supposed to be, you're just supposed to spew all of your ideas onto the page. Also keep a notebook or keep various notebooks with you, because ideas are going to come to you at the least convenient times. I have many a cocktail napkin with notes written on it and a little notebook next to my bed always for those 3 a.m. brainstorms. Just really don't be afraid to just get your story out there and know it's not supposed to be pretty and perfect at first. You know, you just want to get your ideas on paper, because you need the massive block of clay in order to sculpt the beautiful, delicate thing from it. So I think, you know, in writing groups that I've had, and I've mentored writers over the years, and I'm currently doing so, I think the idea of perfectionism can get in the way.
Yes.
And it just can't be perfect at first. It'll never be perfect, but it can be perfect enough. Mm-hmm. I used to interview writers when I worked at Random House. We had a literary magazine, and I would interview novelists for it and would always ask them what their process was like, hoping that there would be one answer that 90% of them had, so that I could say, okay, that's the process. There is no one answer. So it's whatever works for you, whether it's handwriting, whether it's writing. I write pretty much exclusively on my laptop, except for those notes that I take. But yeah, just showing up and doing it and knowing that a lot of the magic happens in the revisions. So that first draft is going to be messy.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that, about the messy first draft?
I'm trying to come to grips with that, because I am also dealing with perfectionism on my own. Because if I was able to just push that perfectionism out of my way and just focus on the story that I have going, I'd be a hell of a lot further along in this story. And that to me is the big problem. And that's been something that's been really stumping my progress, even with the edits for From Parts Unknown, which is my other trilogy, the one that's finished. And that one had gone from That one started out as a video game concept. Then it became a script. Then an actual screenplay. Then 10 drafts of that screenplay. Then a novel based on it that only was like about 230-something pages. Then another draft of a screenplay. Then a complete and total just break it down, start from scratch, and rebuilt it as what would eventually be a 5-part serial. And then picking at it some more. And then finally releasing it as one big omnibus edition. And now that it's with Ronan Weatherford, and I had a wonderful conversation with Casey about this, and because we were talking about the best way to present this, it's actually going to be broken up again, but into a trilogy. So parts one and two are going to be book one, and parts three and four are going to be book two. And then part five, since that was the biggest part of it all, is going to be part three. And so the structure is there, and it's already been through a round of editing. And so it's all right there. The roadmap is in front of me. The fact that I just have to write a new beginning of it to really set the stage better. Again, it's that perfectionism that's blocking my path. But there's so much more that's already done. And a lot of it is just a cleanup, just trying to fix the head hopping that I didn't even realize was happening. So
the stuff that's easier in execution than it sounds when you're given these, it sounds like a vast undertaking, but once you actually get into it, it probably isn't in order to clean up the head hopping or whatever it is that's holding the story back.
I'm just going to put the opening chapter aside and just clean up the rest for now and just go through what's there and see what I can do about that and get that to be the best it can, because that's when I'll feel like, oh, I've made progress. Because right now I'm just stuck at that starting line right now with the same section.
Yeah, I did that with mine as well. I knew that there was something tonally that I need, the one that I'm working on now, that I needed to change. Mm-hmm. And one detail that carries through that I needed to change, but I was feeling so stuck that I went back to the beginning and changed it from the beginning. So I'm in the opposite, because it's toward the end that I need to really get going. But there is something valuable about going in and cleaning up the work that's already there.
Yeah. And so with your, definitely with your background in editing, that's also definitely something there that says to that.
Yeah.
And can people actually access all those articles that you've written for like the New York Post, you've written for Daily News, you've written for Simon & Schuster, right? And
For Random House and Simon & Schuster's websites. I wrote some book reviews for the Daily News, and I wrote for the New York Post for Page Six, which is their gossip column. Some of my stuff you can find online, but I've written for so many different sites and magazines over the years, many of which are no longer in existence. Print magazines. I wrote for Gotham magazine and then their LA counterpart, which was LA Confidential, I want to say. Mm-hmm. Neither of which are still in print, but I got to do some great pieces for them. So yeah, if you come over, I can show anybody who wants to see them a bunch of clips of my past writings. Some of it is online. Some of it can be found online.
Nice.
And certainly everything I've written related to Coat Check Girl, I did some freelance articles around that. That's all online. I haven't written anything yet about Book of Reservations except for my own blog posts on my website.
Do you have a title for the third one? Are you prepared to share it, or is it still?
I do not yet have a title. Titles are hard and so important.
They definitely are.
At least when I came up with Book of Reservations, we batted around a lot of different possibilities for that, and none of them just felt quite right. And something about that one, pointing out the play on words and everything, it hit right. So I don't know. I guess I need to see what book three is really about before I can title it. Do you have titles
absolutely.
For yours?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. The original five titles for From Parts Unknown, part one, it was called The Blunt Object Amendment. Part two is The Age of Submission. So parts one and two are going to be combined. So I'm either going to have to pick one of those titles or start up or think of a whole new title. Part three is Loser Leaves Town. Part four is Looking Up at the Lights, which I really like Looking Up at the Lights. So I think that's going to be part two.
I do too. Okay.
And then part five has always been called Winner Takes All.
Right.
And that one may stay. We'll see. but I definitely know that Looking Up at the Lights is going to be the title for part two.
Oh, okay. Winter Takes All. It's a nice way to kind of wrap up the entire thing.
Yeah. And especially considering what the overall story is and what the event that everything is kind of moving toward really does. It really does mean Winter Takes All, because it's all about what the future of this company, the Gladiatorial Combat League, is going to have going forward, and which I'm very excited about. But the other ones are Excelsior, and then there's Ever Upward for part mm-hmm. two, which I also have to say, like, when I loved and still love that first Excelsior book, but Ever Upward is really special to me because I think it was just because there was so much of the mythology of the character that mm-hmm. goes that filled those Steno notebooks. Mm-hmm. All of that found its way into this story. And then part three is Greater Glory. Great. And that was really something that when I heard Stan Lee talk about the origin of when he looked up the definition of the word Excelsior, and he said that it's an old English phrase which means onward and upward to greater glory. And I was like, greater glory. That's part three right there. And I'm so thrilled to say that when I met Stan Lee in 2008, I got to tell him about this character. And
how cool.
That was an amazing moment, because he's one of the guys that made that phrase Excelsior popular. He would always end his Stan Soapbox articles at the end of the issues with the big phrase Excelsior. That was a wonderful story. And he was signing copies of his book there. And the guy right in front of me had a couple other items that he would like Stan to sign, but they only said, like, he'll sign the book and then he'll sign one other item. So he handed me the other item so I can get it signed right. for him. But it bought me those few extra seconds, because I got to tell Stan that I just want to say thank you so much for not only creating these characters, but inspiring me to create my own. And he looks at me with a big smile and just goes, oh, great, more competition. And it was, and I said to him, one character specifically was inspired by you. And I leaned forward and I said, his name is Excelsior. And he got the biggest smile on his face, goes, oh, that's great. And shook my hand and wished me luck on it. And that was before I started writing the actual first draft. Wow. And so I was like, you know what? I'm never going to get blessed by the Pope. This is close.
That is pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. So wow.
Yeah. So those moments, that's why we do these things.
That is why we do these things.
And where can my listeners find you on social media?
I have a website, laurabuchwald.com, BUCHWALD. I'm also mm-hmm. on the Facebook, Laura Buchwald yep. author page, and on Instagram as well.
Excellent.
And yes, I'm on TikTok, but I don't do anything on there.
So yeah. That one, I know a feeling.
TikTok scares me.
Yeah. For me, it's definitely, it feels like you're under more pressure to create over there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely something. But just like you said, when that story is ready to go, you have to mm-hmm. sit down, you have to put the work in, you have to commit to it. And I hope that all of you who have been listening are doing the same thing. Yeah. Those stories that are building up inside of us, that's common for all of us, whether you're an author or an aspiring author. But the difference between the two of them is the actual author is the one that sits down and puts the work in and gets those stories out. So I really hope that all of you are doing that. I hope that all of you are taking the time to get these stories out. Give yourself permission to write crap and then go back and fix. Do not
100%.
Hit anything. Do not hit delete on anything. Go back in, get those new drafts in. Number them, because you're going to need multiple numbers on them, and just keep on chipping away at this, because it's worth it to get these stories out. You are worth it because you're the one that has this sort of passion in you to get these stories to completion. So I know that Laura is rooting for you. I am definitely rooting for you, and your whole author community is rooting for you, because in these crazy times, we need your stories, your vision, your ideas now more than ever. So for Laura Buchwald, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to george@hesgotit.com.